Morning. Good to see you all here. And yeah, I'm happy to be here. I want to talk about identities this weekend and whether we are born with these identities or whether we get to choose them and how we interact with these identities. So if you have notes, a piece of paper and a pencil, that's great. If not, just make up on your hand five identities that you have, five groups you're part of, five characteristics, five identities that make you you, and write them down or memorize them in your hands. And don't include relationships, like I'm a nephew, I'm a niece, I'm an uncle, I'm a sister, brother, boyfriend, girlfriend, just groups, categories, identities you have other than relationships. So take a few minutes for that. So five identities, groups. If people say, you know, who are you? What would you say in your bio about what makes you you? Okay, now to five and cross one off, eliminate it from your hand. It's no longer you. If it's either or multiple categories, you're no longer part of that category. If there was us versus them, you're now part of the them. You're outside of that group. Cross it off your existence. So basically get rid of your least favorite one. Okay, now we're down to our four top core identities. Cross off another one, get rid of it. You're now part of whatever that was. You're down to your top three favorite core identities. Okay, cross off another one. Is it starting to hurt at all yet? A little bit maybe. You're now some out, you know, we might not even recognize you anymore. People thought they knew you and now they don't because you got rid of those three identities. Down to your top two core identities, core groups you're part of, and cross off one more. You're down to your top core identity. Anyone want to share what you're left with?
Christian.
Okay. Anybody have something that's not Christian? This is not to be a trick, but I know I'm speaking to a very specialized audience here, so if you all have Christian, that's great. Anabaptist, good. Anyone else? What did you have to get rid of? What did you have to jettison from your identities? Anything that it kind of hurt to give it up? You're like, ah, sorry, mom and dad, but I'm no longer whatever that is. Anybody, what did you have to give up? Okay. You're now part of the Smiths or the Joneses or the Zooks of all things. So, okay. Sorry. That's gotta hurt. Anybody else? What'd you give up? Okay. You're now a sixth grade dropout. I'm sorry. You. Anybody else?
Hunter.
Okay. You're now spending your Saturdays at art galleries. Okay, so we're looking at five different categories this weekend, and many of you have other categories here of identities, but we're looking at five identities. We're looking at gender, then after break, class, social class, then tomorrow. I do not have PowerPoint for tomorrow. I like to keep Sunday mornings kind of less high-tech, and so tomorrow for our sermons there, we're going to have citizenship and affiliation, which comes back to Anabaptist and so forth. So right now, though, gender. I want to talk real quickly about a children's story that my oldest son received. He's not here this week. He's in Texas. But he got a gift when he was one about Ferdinand the Bull. And Ferdinand was this bull in Spain living in the countryside. and he's a bull, so he's a male. I didn't get that at first. I grew up in the inner city, and so bulls, cows, but now I get it, that there is about gender. So he was a bull, so he's a male, and he decided to not pal around with the other bulls and clash horns together, and he just liked to sit and smell the flowers. And so anyways, the recruiters are coming from Madrid, and they want to find the most ferocious bull to fight in their bullfights in Spain. And they come in here, and they look around, and Ferdinand's just sitting there smelling the flowers. The other bulls are showing off and clashing their horns. Those are ferocious bulls. But all of a sudden, Ferdinand sits in a flower patch on top of a bumblebee, gets stung, leaps up, kind of snorting around, like, hey, that's the bull we want. They take him to Madrid, and he goes in and smells the flowers and the hats and decides he doesn't want to fight anyways. And the matador gets all stormy because he can't show off in front of this bull, just sort of sniffing roses. And so it all fails. He goes back to the countryside and retires without fighting. Well, good for him. I've been to a bullfight a teenager, and the bulls die. Sorry if that ruins it for you, but the bulls die, and so he was smart to this. On one hand, we could look at this as non-resistance. He's a pacifist or something, but actually, I think it's more about masculinity. The bulls are supposed to be, you know, ferocious, but he wasn't having any of it. So does this make him less of a bull? No, he's still a bull. He still has the horns, still has the biological category of a bull. So we look at the idea of gender. We obviously hear this about sex. Sex is category of male or female, how people are born. That's their biological birth is what we call their, we assign, you go to the doctor's office and, you know, have the baby. The doctor says, okay, given the biology of this child, this is a boy. And that's the sex of the boy, or the sex of the baby. We did have one doctor for one of my children that when the head came out, the doctor says, it's a girl. It came out. I said, it's a boy. And I was right. So I don't know how they thought they could choose from the head, but I didn't really have a lot of credibility for that physician. But and if you're wondering, he's sitting up here on the front row this morning as a fully. Okay, so that's biology. Now, gender, though, is considered in many cases a social construct. We kind of socialize or construct our identity. And this is where you get to choose, according to many sociologists and social scientists, have social construction of gender. Gender being how you identify, and some would say this doesn't have to go with what you were born, what the physician or your parents realized you were at birth. So, do we have more than two genders? You might hear more than three genders. Well, President Trump, on his inauguration day, gave a speech and says there's only going to be two genders from now on. So this got a lot of pushback on this, but the idea of gender being tied to sex, being tied to how you were born biologically, is a very biblical characteristic. And what you would rather do, are you someone, a male, but you begin to question because you have other interests, perhaps. And so maybe you're a male who, instead of playing volleyball today, you'd rather go to a sewing circle. Or I heard our hunter up here had trouble getting up, and I joked about him going to an art gallery, but actually, if I had to choose, I'd go for the art gallery every time. Hands down, I've never hunted. Now, I grew up in the inner city, and I'm following my dad. My dad, we go to museums on Saturdays. And so for me, it's very masculine to go to museums, to be the I love museums. And so for me, I don't see that as a less than masculine thing. But sometimes society says, well, these things are more boy-oriented, these things are more girl-oriented, you know, blue versus pink and so forth. Well, they're not in the Bible. So if a girl likes pink, is that, you know, questioning their identity? No. And that's where we have a problem as a society. We get people, you know, so roped into one category. To be a male, you got to like violence, and you gotta like, you know, football, and you gotta like this, and maybe you don't. You're still a bull, but you like other things instead. Maybe you're a female who likes honey. We actually, in our congregation in Baltimore, we're kind of an unusual place. I hear more women talking about going hunting than I do men. And so we have women who have come in to teach at a school there, and the men very few of them, if any of them are our church that hunt right now. So we kind of have maybe a distorted thing. So is that any? Are they any more, you know, or less female because they go hunting? No. So we have things that we say. We get too roped into making people question their identity, and just because you are a guy who stopped hunting as of today, I'm sorry, it doesn't mean you're now all of a sudden a woman and you have to go to the, you know, women's restroom or whatever. No, a biological male, and no less masculine than you were before. And so changing how we view these stereotypes, let's say, or these roles in that way is okay. However, there are certain roles in the Bible, certain ways in which masculinity is described and femininity that is going to be very different, that we don't want to jettison from our arsenal or get rid of. You might begin to question me, but if you had asked, my wife will be here, I guess, at lunchtime, if you had asked us, you know, who does all the shopping? Well, it's me. I love shopping. I love spending. I'm a big shopper. And my wife never goes to the grocery store unless I really can't go that week if I'm away. But I do all the grocery shopping. I do all the mall shopping. I'm like, hey, let's go to the mall. You know, she's like, So I'm the one that's the shopper. I'm still fully masculine. I'm still fully a male. But this idea of there's certain things that we may have interest in, and we don't have to say, oh, because you like that, therefore you have this other identity. For me, I'm only attracted to, my wife, but women in the broader category. And so that's always been my, you know, my thing. Well, that's a very biblical thing. A male should be, you know, attracted to a female. And so these ideas of how things are, and some are biblical and some are not. And the extra biblical ones, we have to be careful of pushing people, you know, you got to like football, you got to like this. And maybe they'd rather sit and read or go to a museum or something. And so given that from the world's perspective, from the secular academic perspective, we're talking about gender identity. We see here that gender identity is a person's, as according to an Ontario textbook, sense of self with respect to being male or female. Gender identity is different from sexual orientation and may be different from birth assigned sex. So sexual orientation, who you're attracted to, and then birth assigned sex is how you were born as a... I'm saying there's actually three different things. One is how you were born. That's when you didn't get a choice on that, but you get a choice on the other two, who you're attracted to and what you enjoy doing and how you want to carry out that role. I would say no, it's all the same. And so your biblical assigned sex should also go along with who you want to mate with and live with and partner with, and all should also go along with how you identify your gender. And of course, yeah, with the caveat or the disclaimer that maybe you'll have other interests in how you carry out your leisure that may not fit in with everything. But there are certain things that we know biblically that are messed with, including how we dress and so forth. We want to be distinct. Keep the sexes distinct. I'll talk about that in a little bit. Now, a number of years ago, the president of Harvard got into a lot of trouble when he was talking about the STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, math, and why more males were going into that at Harvard and other colleges across the country as opposed to females. And he said, well, better at science than women. Huge outcry because this was not true. And he eventually got dismissed from his cushy job there. And the idea was to say that some people's brains are more geared toward others. Well, you might find a male who's, you know, a great painter and a female who's a great chemist. And so to say that you know, one has a natural advantage in the other, that's not biologically correct. And so he was being, but it was very unpopular. So our world is moving to the idea that we should allow men and women to follow their interests and follow their academic pursuits, perhaps, and not just push women into certain categories. And so our teachers and nurses and men to be doctors and uh, manual laborers and construction workers and so forth. So trying to that, maybe there can be some crossover here, and we don't have to have these necessarily stereotypes in mind. If we look at doctoral degrees in 2020, you can see here that males and females have some differences. In the physical and earth sciences, there's more males, math, and so forth, but then you get into health and medical sciences, more females. Sociology, social and behavioral sciences, more females. Engineering, more males. Education, more females. And so we still sort of have these divides. However, overall, we're seeing that women are getting more PhDs than males across the country. There's more women in college than there are males. Of how it used to be. It used to be that men were the ones going on for higher education or that were being taught in some countries to read at all. You go to some Middle Eastern countries and it was very controversial to even teach a girl to read. And so in this country, we've kind of flipped now. We're becoming much more educated and going on for higher education. And so this could create an imbalance someday if they'll be getting paid more than men. And so this might flip how people view marriage relationships. Will women be making more than their husbands? And are they less of a female? Is the husband less of a man? These things can be very detrimental to society and create division that doesn't have to be there. And but the idea that we have moved on, and in many cases this is progress, that we're not hold young girls back and say, no, you can't be this, you can't be that. And so if we look at the idea of how women are perceived and how men are perceived, we also see some other things that go in addition to education. We might look at reputation in terms of crime. This chart talks about a prison gender gap, where the bulk of people in prisons are going to be male, female. And so in the U.S. population, males are much more likely to be the ones in prison compared to women. Now, you might hear there's some biology to that, like for some young men until they get to the age of 25, there's certain things that might not be quite wired the same as other people, and so maybe they're more reckless at a young age, and so there's some of that could be biological. But some of this could also be a social construct in terms of are men expected to be the ones to be a little more trained to be, you know, more violent and more, you know, into, well, hopefully not murder, but that kind of thing. You know, a feud. You don't think of, you know, women back in the 1700s having feuds at sunrise. It's always the men you hear about. And so, but is it more violent or just because they were the ones expected to go into this role? We're seeing women now in combat who are performing every bit as well as men. And the idea is that they can do physically what a lot of men can do, but are they being in that direction? Whereas men are always, you know, they're the ones that go off and be soldiers and so forth. Now, not us, because we'll see tomorrow, we are hopefully not violent like that. But there is a sort of pressure in society that men are to, you know, solve things with their fists and women to be more. That may not come natural. I've seen young girls who can be very violent and so forth. And so it's not necessarily men that are always the violent ones. But this idea is that is this how we're born, that we by nature as men are more violent, less violent, or is this something that we are trained to do? Like you're being told by your dad, you got to solve that problem. Don't let that bully, you got to defend your sister or whatever. So we have these expectations that could be choices to some degree that don't go necessarily violence. There was I teach political science. There's a political scientist back in the 1990s that said that political violence is a result of male-dominated politics because males have been dominating politics as heads of state, as ministers and kings for so long. There's been exceptions, but the majority of men have been, majority of those positions have been held by men. Therefore, that's why we have violence. Well, maybe or maybe not. Maybe it's just because there's more men that were told you should be king, and therefore if you're a king, emperor, you're the head of state, yeah, you got to defend your country, so you will be more violent perhaps. And so, but maybe you're like Ferdinand the Bull that says, I don't want to fight, and then you're saying, well, you know, you're not a real man. So being told that into people might make people move in this direction of being more into crimes and so forth because they're told you got to you know, showed off to the gang members that you are worthy of your initiation and what have you. Now let's look at the Genesis chapter 5. Genesis chapter 5. Start with verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him, male and female created him, and called their name Adam in the day when they were created. So Adam here was a name God gave to humans in general. He says here he called them Adam. So Adam then called Eve, to differentiate them, but God called them Adam. So we were humans that God created. And then it says Adam lived 130 years, and begat a son in his own likeness after his image and called his name Seth. So now instead of being created in God, created in the image, or are born in the image of their earthly fathers. And so here we get this idea of sons and fathers begatting each other. And not that the fathers don't begat the daughters, but the sons are then in their image as little men. But this idea of Adam as a name applied to all humans. In God's eyes, he created us as humans, and we are equal. You know, you've probably heard the idea that Eve was not taken from Adam's foot or just from his side. They're equal and so forth. And so in that sense, in God's eyes, we're all the same. But we have tried to differentiate ourselves. And over time, some of this differentiation has become very biblical. The Lord tells us in Deuteronomy that we are not to put on, if you're a man, what pertaineth to a woman. Deuteronomy 22:5. I'll just turn there very briefly. The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all the nation unto the Lord thy God. Now, we're not told in the Bible exactly what is a woman's garment, what's a man's garment, but people know at that time what that was, and so it would look different than what we have today, but people would recognize, you know, you might togas in ancient Rome and say, well, you know, neither of them are wearing pants. Well, but people would recognize that's a male toga and that's a, you know, woman's robe or whatever. They would recognize the difference. So whatever your sociological construct is, in our society, pants would be the idea for men, skirts, dresses for women. And so we have this separation. So that may differ by culture, in, you know, which part of the world you live in, but it's still recognizable that, you know, cultures will have some distinction between here's what men wear and from a distance you can woman, and that's to be acknowledged. Well, we've had a society that has been pushing back against this in American society, and so this idea of going unisex, that, you know, anybody can wear the same thing. Well, the first of this gender confusion was what we call maybe unisex fashion, and so it's a photo of two movie stars who are in a film here, and very similar, the woman on the left, the man on the right, and the man on the right is, you know, you might say he looks like he could fit into any masculine Mennonite church today. The one on the left, not so much. And it's often, in our society, often women that have changed over the past. Now, we're seeing some differences, but the first wave is usually women that were changing to wear what men were wearing, and often it's about power. So, you notice she's dressed with, like, a power tie here, a dress vest, and so forth. So, is it because men, the power holders of society, the business executives, the presidents, the prime ministers, and so forth, were dressed in this way? And so women thought, if we're going to have power, if we're going to have any place in society, we also need to dress like. So you get this idea that the first wave of change, of pushback against Deuteronomy 22 and in our society was often women dressing like men. And beginning, it's because this is the unequal power patriarchy in society that men have dominated, kept all the cushy positions for themselves, and women didn't have the ability to be taken seriously unless they were wearing, you know, the westernized suit and so forth. So that's kind of one phase. The second phase, and we're seeing this much more recently, become more common on runways and fashion, is this unisex fashion where men are dressing in a more effeminate way. And this is where we get into, it's not about power anymore in society. It's about this attempt to maybe reduce either the distinction between the genders or to make men less masculine. So this is where we get a lot of potential problems as well. And then the idea of the unisex fashion is this to confuse. And so this is just a picture I grabbed off online. I don't know who this was. I don't know how they were born or who they were born as. But you can see the hair is kind of longish, but kind of shortish, but kind of long too. And you know, they're wearing cosmetics and so forth. It's a little hard to see. Are they male? Are they female? And so unisex now with the idea of confusion. We'll walk into our local grocery store and see a, and of course I'm the one doing the grocery shopping, but my three youngest have been helping me on most Monday evenings. We go grocery shopping together. And there's this, well, the store that we go to, there's a number of people in, as employees who are, it's kind of hard to say what they are. Long hair, deep voices, so very a large wrist that they look like the bone structure of a man, but then they have anatomical features of a female in their upper body. My 4-year-old last year was kind of looking like, and my children were debating, my 4-year-old and my 7-year-old were debating, is that a male or a woman? And so they're confused, I'm confused. Distance, it's hard to tell. And so what is the purpose behind this? Is this to confuse people? It could confuse people's orientation. If they walk in the grocery store and say, oh, that person's attracted, and they find out, uh-oh, it's a man instead of a woman, then am I therefore attracted to men? Or if it's a female. And so this confusion gets people to question then their orientation, who they're attracted to. And that's going to lead to other deeper sins in the Bible in terms of, it's one thing about how you dress, but then the idea of how you be an issue as well. And so the Bible has a very clear order for how this all to take place and how we are to be born and how to fill our roles. But many people are not satisfied with the roles, the identity that we are born with. If we go to 1 Corinthians 11, we get the headship order. First Corinthians 11, verse 3. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. See this order, and this illustrated as envisioned as umbrellas, a bigger umbrella with Christ kind of reigning over. Then you have the husband here, who is the provider, the protector, family unit, and then you have the wife who is the manager of the home and over the children and so forth. So this headship order, and we get this idea that that might not seem equal. Well, no, we're equal to God the Father or to Christ. So it's not going to be. We're not talking about equality here in that sense, but we're talking about different roles. And is this a hierarchical thing that men are over women? So I want to look at that idea of this. So it comes from the Bible, head of the home here. But how does that get carried out in our society and also in our churches today? And so Genesis chapter 3, going back to the beginning here, Genesis 3, we see that Adam and Eve are in the garden, and the serpent comes along and tries to tempt Eve. The serpent was more in the field, which the Lord God had made, and he said unto the woman, yea, hath God said, you shall not eat out of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. And they get into this debate about, why should you eat this? Your eyes will be opened, and so forth. Well, she does this. She eats the fruit, and then gives to her husband, who later we're told in the New Testament was not deceived. He did this knowingly, and he also sinned. And so this idea that Satan bypass the head of the home to Eve. And so Satan's idea is trying to mess up the structure that God created, this idea that the husband is to provide protection for the wife. Satan went straight to Eve. But notice, who does God go to? God goes to Adam first. God confronts Adam about his sin first. In God's eyes, Adam is responsible for this. Adam is the head of the household. And so when God comes to the garden looking around, his first thing was, calls unto Adam and said unto him, "Where art thou?" Well, Adam's hiding. He's not taking full responsibility for the sin that he did as well. And so God approaches Adam. Satan approaches Eve. Satan has been trying and trying from the very beginning of Genesis mess up this order of how God created us. Not that God, again, God created them equal, side to side, rib to rib. He called them both Adam, but it's already beginning to set aside there is a special place. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Well, let's go to 23. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." So Adam gave woman the name woman. He named her. "Therefore shall man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." And so God's ideal, which is later quoted by Jesus in the New Testament, God's ideal leads to clarity. And it's going to be male and female. Male and female created he them. He didn't create, even though he called them both Adam, as like, "You're human." But he created them biologically distinct. And he gave them roles, separate roles. And right here from the very beginning, before Satan gets involved in this, initiative, the man will leave his father and mother and take initiative and cleave unto the wife. And of course, there will be the miracle of marriage, where 1 + 1 = 1. They merge and become one flesh in a miraculous way. But Satan's not satisfied with that. He wants to break apart marriages, the order in which things take place, wants to break apart the biological construct that God made, which was very clear, has very clear definitions, and it allows for peace. You know your role. You know your position. Now, what if you are a man, or you're not married, you're a woman? Does that mean you're, I don't know. There's definitely a role for people who are not partnered up and married as well. And so, but either way, it's still God's provision of peace. Now, I that, and I have a whole sermon on how this takes place in the church. You know, why this is about women speaking in church and so forth. I think it's been taken way out of line. I even hear people saying women shouldn't pray out loud in church. That's not what I see. I think it's a very specific thing about women teaching theology. It comes back to Adam and Eve being deceived. So women are not to teach theology. But aside from that, they can be President of the United States, they can be, you know, any role you want to put them in. That's not, they can be the boss, they can be your boss. I have, my boss is a male, but my boss's boss is female, my boss's boss's boss is female, and it goes up the chain for a while. And so, yeah, it's okay to have female bosses over males. That's not, the only thing that really is restricted in the Bible, how they are to be teaching theology and being elders of churches. That's a role restricted for men. But for women, that's not their calling in that sense, but it doesn't mean they're less equal in God's eyes. So Genesis 2:24, here we have clarity and purpose. The man cleaving the wife, and we're told in the Bible that Eve was a help for Adam. Now, we often hear the word, she was an help meet, but that's because people are maybe English, help meet means she's a help that's suitable or capable. So meet means capable, suitable, but the word is, the noun is help. She's a help for her husband. Well, yeah, I'd admit men need more help than women. It was pretty flat out across the board. Look at statistics. Married men live longer than non-married men. For women, it doesn't make a difference. If you're married or single, same lifespan, not a lot of difference. So yeah, we men don't have as much lives, perhaps, as they had ours. My wife today, I was eating breakfast with my nephew and niece, the Drambys, and Grandma W., who goes to church with many of you. And yes, great breakfast, you know, bacon, potatoes, and the donuts pull out, and then my wife offered me an orange. So yeah, I'm going to live longer because she's there to remind me to eat my orange, not just, you know, eat all the donuts or whatever. So yeah, so there is some element to that. I think it's probably a truth. A young woman in our congregation years ago who was like, I'm not going to get married. I can be much more on fire for the Lord. She had a great ministry with international people, bring international college students to our church. It was wonderful when she was single and there. And so, yeah, you know, and sort of ate her words. But she used to say that men, you know, men should get married, but women is optional. Well, she said, convents are okay, but monasteries are not okay. So think about that. Convents, monasteries for monks. So she says, convents are okay. It's okay for women not to get married, but for men, you need help. Basically, we've told our children, no pressure on getting married unless you're a boy. You know, at some point, basically, I'll sort of say that half jokingly, but the idea is that I do believe men are better off, but men have to take the initiative. You know, and part of the reason we say this, you know, if you're a female and not able to take the initiative, and you know, in our Mennonite culture, that might be something to, you know, oh no, she started this relationship first. Well, my wife talked to me first, but she just talked. She's just more, you know, more friendly than I am, I guess. So, but I'm the one that asked her out on the first date, so I had to eventually get out of my seat and, you know, send the email. And I gave her my email, my business card, and we swapped information. But she said, I was never going to email you. I didn't know that. I was waiting for her, but no. So I finally emailed her, and we were married in less than a year. So I eventually could move once I got moving. But sometimes it takes the husbands, they're the ones that have to take the first move. They leave their father and mother and cleave to their wife, and that's biblical. Having said that, it's okay to be friendly and to be outgoing, and no shame. Well, sometimes men do need a little prodding. Okay, so now this idea, though, of this headship order, as I said, could lead to some issues. Leader. This guy is, you know, just walking along, smoking or whatever, and his wife is carrying, that looks like a beast of burden here. This is a problem. He looks fully capable of, you know, carrying his own weight, but does he think that she's the one, that's a woman's job to carry the... So there have been histories of men taking this, you know, biblical role as head of households. They run with it. They abuse their power, and it's like, yeah, I can do whatever I want, and the wife has to be, you know, the one who manages everything and does all the work, and this becomes a potential problem. Now, there have been men, there are men who are abused by their domestic partners, but the vast majority statistically are men abusing. This also becomes a problem when men begin to take it out violently on their partner and use their position of power as a way to rule or lord over them. Now, we might have ideals about what feel for how men and women can interact, and you think back to maybe early childhood stories of, you know, the proper roles of men and women. And so if you think of a prince and a princess, what is the prince for the princess in many fairy tale stories? What does he do? Carries them out of the castle. He's the one, the knight in shining armor that comes along and rescues them. And sometimes, you know, we as humans might think that even our women today should be waiting for the knight in shining armor, and they might not exist. Might be a little bit rusty on the edges, but they're trying their best, perhaps. But this idea of armor who rescues them, and then in the aftermath, well, he lorded over Cinderella and say, "I rescued you. You were nothing. You were there among the cinders, and I rescued you there. Therefore, you can." I'm going to lord over you, and you owe me that I came in and rescued you from your awful existence as you know, a waif in the fireplace here, and I rescued you, and therefore, sir. Well, a lot of men, you know, they think they did all the action they needed to when they wooed their wife, and now it's time to, you know, sit on the couch and let her do everything for them, and so we have a problem here. In the Soviet Union, back during the there was the idea they're going to try to be fully equal. They're going to try to make everything just equal and have an equal society. We'll talk about class, social class later, but they were trying to do that with gender as well. So men and women being equal, and so everybody had to work, didn't have a choice. Didn't care, Mary, if you have children. Okay, we have a government daycare to take care of the children. No excuses. Everybody works outside the home. So males and females, husbands and wives, everybody works. Fully equal, everybody gets equal pay. Still is trouble in the U.S. getting equal pay for equal work, but equal pay. Just a little kick here on other things. I've heard of Mennonite parachurch organizations that didn't pay women as much as men. They're like, well, men are heads of households. They have more people they're responsible for necessarily. And so why pay a man more than a woman? Why let the son inherit more than the wife? I'm all about equality when it comes to equal pay for equal work. However, in the Soviet Union, they got into this idea that, okay, equal pay for equal work, everybody outside the home. Well, they come back to their apartments or houses at night, and the men were like, I worked a full day's work. I'm going to sit on the couch. And the woman's now doing what they call the double work week. Because she gets so much. She's doing all the cleaning and chores and child rearing and so forth. So even communism tried to create this equal society, people's old ideas about how to do things played a role, and they came back. And so women ended up doing twice the amount of work. They worked, now they had to work outside the home, but now they also kept doing everything inside and couldn't quite deal with that. How to, you know, they couldn't monitor everything in the house after work hours. And so men and women still did that, but the problem was now women were expected to do double time because they had to work outside the home plus do work inside the home. Is that now in our society today, we're told, well, we got to have two incomes. In American society, you can't survive without two incomes. That's what we're told. And so, therefore, you know, if women feel they have to work outside the home to make ends meet, well, will they come back and still have the husband laying on the couch and the woman not so much? And there's something maybe biological about this, that women just naturally do more with children. Walk along the reflecting pool in D.C. where I lived years ago, and it was Father's Day. We're in a Father's Day sermon, and about 2 weeks before Father's Day, I come across this duck family. I was like, wow, this is such a cute family, and so forth. The second week I go, and there's a father duck, you know, the one that's more colorful, and there's the mother duck, and there's the little baby ducks, all seven of them following their, so this is so cute. I came back the next week and walked around the reflecting pool, and but the father's now somewhere else. We don't know where he was. And the mother is here with a little duck. And so it just came naturally. She's the one that's going to stay with the babies. Well, is that wrong? Is that patriarchal oppression? We don't know where the father was. Is another duck family? Is he off hunting? Or I don't know what ducks eat, but you know, he's off, you know, gathering food for them or whatever. Or maybe he's just lazy and he's just like, I did my duty and, you know, I got them out of the nest and taught them how to swim and now they're on their own. Some more training. And so sometimes we have this, is there a natural instinct here of motherhood? Well, we see in scripture a lot of ways in which women are referred to and how men are referred to. And there is something about men who are tied for their household, even provide for some of the other relatives, aunts and so forth, if they are widowed and so forth. So this is a responsibility given to men in that way. But the day-to-day care, there's some biological ways and so forth, has to be done by mothers and you know, ways in which we try to deal with things that women have a special role there. It's going to lead to more work. And so it's going to lead to some inequality perhaps in the workplace. My wife has been at home with my idea, not hers. And we didn't really have a lot of marriage counseling, I guess, before we got married. And I was like, oh, we don't need it. I got this all figured out. And so, but then we were on our honeymoon talking about, you know, what we're going to do when we get back. And she thought she was going to go to work home. And so we had this idea. So we had different ideas about how this is all going to work out. And it's worked out well. She's found ways to find a fulfilling life. And submitted to my ideas that she would not be working outside the house, but she's found many ways to be fulfilled in the work in the home. She has homeschooled our seven children. She also is a college professor in Tennessee, as online virtual tutoring and so forth. She just started nannying for two girls. So she has now 9 children in the family. And she also plays in an orchestra and cello. So she's very busy. So she's making money, but she met my ideal, which was that she would find a way to make it work. But I realized that it wouldn't be great of me to say, you can't do anything you found fulfilling. You know, play your cello or engage in science. She was a biologist and so on. So I realized I'm not going to take my head of the household and say, no, you can't do any of this stuff. We could embrace it. I didn't have to feel threatened by her being a active woman in that sense. And so found ways to do this. However, there is a segment of society that says, you know what? I should stay at home with the children. And maybe it just doesn't matter who it is. Husband or wife, maybe it doesn't matter. So you get the idea of the more modern phenomena, the stay-at-home dads. Now, when I pushed a stroller, I just stopped pushing a stroller a few years ago when my youngest son became 3, now he's 5. But now I pushed the 2 1-year-olds in the nanny daycare a few weeks ago. I said, oh, it feels good to push a stroller again. But stroller, I get lots of glory and praise. People say, oh, you're a good father. You know, random strangers on the street are like, yeah, good for you, you know, taking care of the children. My wife goes out, it's like, you got to help that baby, you know, it's not on his nose or whatever. And she gets none of the glory. It's the expectation. You got to get the hat on. Whereas I'm out, they're like, oh, you know, good for you, a father doing his thing or whatever. So it's not equal. It's expectations of a cultural society. So when men go out with a stroller, when men are, you know, it's like, oh, good for them. When I was in my early 20s, and I loved rollerblading, and there was 2 dads in my neighborhood that also loved rollerblading. They were stay-at-home dads. I was like, great, we can go rollerblading together. When their wives had off work, we'd go rollerblading. But they were the stay-at-home dads, had very high-paying jobs. They were both Christian couples. But both men told me in separate conversations that their wives and their pastors were getting after them, that they should be the ones taking on more responsibility in the workplace. I missed having a rollerblading buddy, but there's resentment from their wives. Why are you making me go off to work? And that, not every woman would be like that, but in their Christian environment, they were feeling like that's your role. I have the money, I have the potential to earn income, but I want you to step up, you to be the man in this sense. Judges chapter 5. I'm sorry, I've been looking at that clock. And I apologize, I have not been looking at the right clock, I guess. So I will wrap this up very shortly because I thought we had like 10:30. I thought I've got to keep going here. So I will make my second half a little shorter so you get your full break. But let me just here. Judges chapter 5, we have Barak and Deborah. And Deborah is the one that God allows to lead Israel because Barak, the first person called to lead them, did not want to shoulder responsibility. She was a prophetess, and he wanted to get in good with God. She's the one who should lead. But she said, the glory is going to go to a woman, not to you, because you didn't take your responsibility. So there is this idea of having the woman take responsibility. Proverbs 31. I won't turn there now. You're probably familiar with the idea of the Proverbs 31. What comes next? The Proverbs 31 woman, okay? It's actually written to a man. It's written to my, you know, Proverbs from King Lemuel to you, my son. We talk about the Proverbs 31 woman. I was talking to a Bible school one time, and there was a young woman there. She had, I think, four babies under the age of 4. Like, it was, she had a lot of children. And Proverbs 31 woman, and she walked out and said, it's just too much pressure. And I saw her a number of years later, and I saw her actually last year at Bible quizzing, and I said, you know what, you're doing a great job. You are the Proverbs 31 woman. And she laughed kind of sheepishly because she had stormed out. But it's actually carry the burden there. The men who are to be the ones to take responsibility. It's the men who are to be known in the gates for their character, for their reputation. Here we see me preaching a sermon with my background with my 2 children who are now here as youth today in her lap there. But this role, is she less than? No, she is the one that Proverbs 31 woman is very active. She's an active agent, active. And we're told that the husband here, he's to avoid strong drink. He's to avoid, you know, strange women. He's to be active as a moral character in society. So men say, you know, okay, the woman will, you know, get up early and spin the wool and, you know, buy real estate and run the business, and the men can just laze around. No, that's not what that passage is implying. It's giving women the ability, emphasizing they are human agents as well, have responsibility to be, you know, with their family, to be loyal and so forth. So it's a choice. You can be a lazy father. You can be a lazy person. It doesn't take much to become a father. It takes 9 months to become a mother. A lot more pain and suffering for a mother. After that, are you going to be a father? Are you going to be a mother? And so God is calling individuals here to not to be unequal, but to take on the role they've been given at birth. But that was from God's, he wanted you to be. If any of you crossed off the role of man or woman today, I know hopefully you kept Christian as your ultimate one, but you want to keep that. You want to keep whatever you were given and embrace that and find ways to live with that. Maybe it means you're a woman, you want to go out in the nature and go hunting. That's okay, you know. But you find ways to embrace what you want to, how you want to do it. But emphasize, God made you that way. He loved you that way. He made you, all of you. He called you all Adam. You're all God bless.